One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
It's all about the macro productions.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Momai Gutavi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macro aggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macro Aggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rumble, Band.video, Vigilante TV, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate it. We know you've got a lot of choices out there. Glad that you like the show. Hopefully you've rated it. Give us 5 stars if you think we've earned it as we fight this ridiculous algorithm battle. If you want to connect with me, the best website for that is macroaggressions.io. That has information about the books, podcasts. You can get links there to activistpost.com, to naturalblaze.com if you're interested in bookmarking those sites for your news sources. I think it's a good one. We republish articles from outstanding brave journalists from around the world. So check out Activist Post. We cannot do this show without our sponsors, and luckily we've got fantastic ones. Wise Wolf, Tony Arterburn, and his team over at Wise Wolf have been with me for a very long time. They have a system called Wolfpack. It's an automated buy-in program for silver and gold. Every month you just set it up. However, they've got different tiers of that. You set the amount that you're comfortable with, and you can just get a big box delivered to you once a month. Open it up. It's like Christmas morning. You're going to find silver coins in there, or maybe little 1 gram gold tabs in there, and a variety of things. He picks out the best bang for your buck, and it's a wonderful way to get yourself into silver and to dollar cost average into this. So you don't have to get, you know, be too fixated on the current price of silver. You're going to be buying it every month. It'll all work itself out in the end. If you're interested in learning more about this, go to macroaggressions.gold and you'll find links to everything that Tony's doing over there. I've been a customer of theirs since it started a little over 2 years ago, and it's great. I'm stacking silver without even really trying to. So if you're interested, macroaggressions.gold is the place for that. Also, do you have storable food? You better. We don't know what's coming. But if you've got a couple months supply of food, you'll feel a little bit better about how things turn out. And if you've already got food, good for you. Maybe pick some up for a family member who's out of state or somebody who thinks you're crazy for prepping like this. But if you're interested in finding out more about this, you can go to a website that the folks over at My Patriot Supply made specifically for our show. Go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and you can knock it all out in about 10 minutes. Get yourself storable food for 3 months, 6 months, an entire year. They have survival gear. They have camping gear. There's a lot going on over there. So if you haven't checked it out already, just take a look at the website. The links are down in the show notes for all of these. Preparewithmacroaggressions.com. They always have discounts going over there, sales happening. So check it out and see what you think. All right. Well, he's back, ladies and gentlemen. The author of the Upside Down series is back here on Macroaggressions, TNT Radio. We've done it before, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Gober. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm well, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always good to see you. I love your book series. It's such a smart idea. And you're up to 7 of them now? Is that right?
Correct.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, as somebody who writes books myself, I know it's like, I think it's like how women describe childbirth. Like, it's so painful that, but there's something about your mind that just forgets the pain. And then you wind up working on another book and then you get about 3/4 way through and you go, oh yeah, I remember why I hated this so much. It's so stressful and there's so much to do, but you seem to find a way to do it. What's going on with the new book, An End to Upside Down Cosmos? Oh baby, I'm into it. NASA, Moon story, firmament, flat earth. I'm down for all of this. What did you learn while you were writing this book?
Well, this was not a topic I had been focused on until pretty recently. As we all know, more and more people are asking questions about cosmology. But I was writing other books and other things, so never had time to really look at it. And I'd hear some people say, oh, this is all just a psyop that's intended to distract the truthers. And then other people who I respect a lot saying, no, this is a really important topic to look at. And it wasn't until April of 2024, I went to a festival called Confluence in Bandera, Texas, and it was run by Alex Zeck of The Way Forward. And around that time, there was a book that came out, which has become very popular. It's called A Fool's Wisdom by Dr. Stephen A. Young. He's a theoretical physics PhD. Okay, so highly credible guy in the field. And he writes in that book something to this effect. After looking at this question for a long time, meaning shape of the earth, cosmology, I came to 100% knowing, that earth is not a spinning globe, even though I don't know with 100% certainty what earth is. And he went through some of the reasoning, and I thought that's pretty interesting for a guy who that highly credentialed to say he looked at this for years and was coming to that sort of conclusion. And then I also found that many people who were questioning topics that I discuss in my medicine book called An End to Upside Down Medicine, those who are questioning whether viruses exist or whether there are other reasons people get sick that are non-viral. Many of the people in that camp were saying to me, Mark, the logical fallacies that you have identified and summarized in your book and End to Upside Down Medicine, I'm telling you, it's the same logical fallacies in cosmology. And the way I would describe it to you now, Charlie, after having gone through these exercises, is that there is a great potential for deception and for misunderstanding innocently. I think there's both. Some people are innocently propagating a narrative, not realizing it's false because they just believe the assumptions. Other people are nefariously doing so. But there's great potential when things are at the ultra small scale or at the ultra big scale, because we're never validating things directly. I'll give an example with regard to viruses. What is the claim made in medicine and virology? There is this particle. It's an obligate intracellular parasite. It gets inside of a host cell. It replicates. It bursts out of that cell, goes into other ones, does the same thing, and in so doing, creates very specific physical disease symptoms in that person. And then that particle goes from one person to another, causing the same symptoms. I just described something very basic. No one has ever seen one part of what I just described. The belief in viruses is all based on indirect evidence. It's a much longer discussion, but it's the same thing with cosmology, where people are making inferences. And the logical fallacy that I'm seeing appear everywhere, it's called affirming the consequent. Very important. It appears in politics too. Basically, where people are jumping to a causal explanation of something and leaving out other possible models. The way it goes more formally is, if X, then Y, therefore X. More simply put, if it rains, the grass outside will be wet. Second statement, I observe wet grass outside, therefore it rained. Why is that such a big problem? Because wet grass doesn't necessarily indicate rain. There are many other reasons. There could be wet grass, sprinklers, dew, parts of biology we don't understand, children running by, pouring buckets of water on the grass. So another way to put this is, just because a model can adequately explain an observation doesn't mean that model is correct. So we see this everywhere where people say, oh, we observed this thing and here's a model that can explain it. Therefore, that model is true, when there could be many other models. And that's really the crux of this whole thing in cosmology, medicine, and beyond.
I had a chance to meet Alex from The Way Forward at an Acapulco. I liked him right off the bat, and Confluent seems like a fantastic event. And had all the, had Dr. Andrew Kaufman with me as well. So it's like I had the virus guy, the no virus guys, the terrain guys there, and this is something that I'm kind of late to the game, I guess. And I didn't really think too much about viruses, no viruses, in the same way I didn't think too much about the shape of the Earth until the last couple of years. And I understand there's this belief that maybe it could be, you want to, split the conspiracy crowd in half and get them fighting amongst each other. And certainly the shape of the Earth would be something that you could do that with. Mm-hmm. Man, I had an experience that was, I suppose, it's like a science experiment on myself, and I don't know that it necessarily proves anything, but during a DMT session on the beach in Acapulco at night, the final time through, the guy I was with said, this time I want you to do it, but I want you to keep your eyes open, and I don't want you to lay back. I want you to stay seated, keep your eyes open, and try it that way. And when I did, one of the things I could see was a very faint grid come out almost out of the sand, and it extended to the horizon. I looked as far as I could see. It extended even back through the back of the sky. I looked up, tilted my head up, looked up. I could see it everywhere. I had this very unusual feeling. It was like a knowing that I was looking at the inside of a dome. I was looking at the firmament. I was looking at something that was, we were in an enclosed system, and that I could see almost like a CAD computer design when they're making, I don't know, Pixar movies, and they have the character, but then they layer, add on to them. And before the final piece where they put the skin on him, he's just a grid-like structure. And it felt like I was looking at the universe that had been peeled back one layer, and I was just seeing this grid, the sort of the architecture of it, the underneath system I was seeing. And when I got done, I looked at the guy I was with, and I said, I saw the grid. I saw a grid, you know? And he said, that's why I asked you to keep your eyes open, because everybody that had smoked this particular strain of DMT was seeing the same thing. And after that, I really started to question a lot, and including the shape of the Earth. I'd already had problems with NASA, and I know that their stories don't add up, and the moon landing is nonsense, and all this. So it wasn't as if I was a normie, but I wasn't quite, Dave Weiss is at the conference too. He said, let me talk to you for an hour, about the shape of the Earth and everything. And I love Dave, and I'm open to all of it. But after that, I felt like I saw things in a different way. What was your feeling before you got into this, and how did your opinion on things like that change after writing this book?
Hmm. Well, let's see. As my journey has progressed from books 1 to 7, let's say, that my earlier books, I would have referred to flat Earth as a theory that we have overcome in science. That was something I used to say as an example of an old paradigm that we overcame. And I compared it to the paradigm shift in regard to consciousness, because my books are about the idea that consciousness does not come from the brain. I said, this is like a scientific revolution, just like we used to believe the Earth is flat now. So I was saying that sort of thing. And then I came across Dave Weiss's work a few years later, probably 2021 or something. And I remember thinking, okay, he makes some interesting points, but the number of assumptions he's peeling back, like this would take me a lot of work to really dive into. And it wasn't until 2024 that I went deep into it. I think one of the issues, it's almost like a marketing and branding issue with this topic, because there is a tendency to jump quickly to just the shape of the Earth. And to me, it's about the nature of the cosmos itself. It's about Earth and its place in the cosmos and what is the cosmos. Because the conventional model is that there was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. Unimaginably long ago. We don't even know what happened last week, let alone, you know, 13.8 billion years ago. And scientists are going to say with certainty that that was the event that started the whole universe, which led to billions of years of things moving around in this massive cosmos, where Earth becomes a spherically shaped object revolving around the sun, or actually free falling around the sun at over 60,000 miles an hour. You need all of these things together. And so that's what I try to do in this book, is to break down each piece of it. So Big Bang, also heliocentrism, which is the idea that Earth revolves around the sun. This was the Copernican Revolution, and Galileo allegedly proved this. We could talk about it. Actually, he didn't prove it. He was just engaging in this logical fallacy of affirming the consequent. But so there's heliocentrism. That's a big part of this. Does Earth revolve around the sun, or is Earth at a central place? And you could have a geocentric model where Earth is at the center, but Earth is a sphere. But it's at the center. So there are all these different layers to it. And what I try to do is to say, these are the assumptions that are put forth to us. This is the model that we're told is true by the physicists and the cosmologists. If there's one part of it that's not right, that means the model has been falsified. It's almost like saying, if there's a law that says all swans are white, and we find a million white swans, but one day we find a single black swan, the law has been falsified, because the law said all swans are white, and all has a very specific meaning. People seem to forget that in science. They're like, oh, it's just an anomaly. Let's sweep it under the rug. So that's what I go less toward. I know, Charlie, with certainty what this place is, more toward we can falsify the existing model. And then what the true answer is, that's up for exploration. And I find for people that's more welcoming, and they're like, oh, I can get behind that because there's some weird stuff. The only reason the Big Bang can work is because there was rapid inflation 13.8 billion years ago, this rapid expansion. And they're saying that that happened because there's an inflaton particle that allowed for the rapid expansion, but no one's ever found an inflaton particle, for example.
There's a lot of nonsense in science, I've come to learn. And as a kid growing up, I thought the science was settled. And apparently there's more to it in every aspect of it, whether it's the medical industry or but specific to me. I have enjoyed the process of looking at the lies that were told. And also the psychological manipulation of people as well. And it started, you know, if you think about it, it really kind of starts. And I think Dave Weiss has mentioned this is probably the reason why I got onto this. But when you're a kid sitting in class, there's a globe over there. There's also a flag. You get up and pledge allegiance to the flag. And that's pretty crazy now that I'm older and look at that. And I think, oh, that, why am I doing that? But also there's just a reminder, there's the globe in there that spins around, you can find all the things. And so it is never a debatable point. It is always delivered to us as settled science. And as I progress through life, I start to find that more and more components of science that I assumed were settled really are not. And so it leads me to this question. It's a bigger question. It's, you know, well, if NASA's lying, and they are, and the media is lying to us about everything, and the government's lying to us about everything, where's the line in the sand that they won't cross? Would it include the place where we live? I mean, if you wanted to destabilize people, wouldn't you sell, you could, as one of tactic, to sell them a story about their own existence and where they are and who they are and why they're there. And then within that, you've built almost like a terrarium of beliefs that, you know, you can't really escape it. You can't get outside of it. And then if for those who do choose to ask questions about it, then we've got the force and power of ridicule at, you know, oh, he's a flat earther, and you know about them, you know, they're all crazy. I mean, or you believe that 9/11 was an inside job. What do you think the moon is, or, you know, you think that the earth is flat and that the moon is a projection? And you're like, well, I don't know. Maybe I have some questions about that too. So, I like that you challenge these established narratives. It's what we should be doing, right? I mean, isn't that? I mean, how do you come at your work? I mean, do you feel Do people criticize you for being subversive? How dare you? Or do they feel a little bit inspired that, well, Mark opened the door for me. He wrote this book. He opened, you know, he gave me an opportunity to get a book and read about this new line of thinking. Like, I should really thank him for that. What's the response been to books, your books in general, but this one in particular about the cosmos?
I have been surprised that the reception has been so positive.
Really?
Yeah. I actually spoke at Confluence again this year in 2025 and got a very positive reception, even among people who hadn't read the book or didn't know of me. And they came up to me and were asking questions. So I think there's something happening in the collective where people are more open to asking these questions, especially when it's positioned as, let me lay a groundwork here for your audience, especially if your audience is new to some of these topics, because I hear a counter argument sometimes. At least when I was researching for this book, of why would you question cosmology? There's so much that we can explain very well with the mainstream cosmology, with a spherical Earth and Earth revolving around the sun and a Big Bang. We've got it pretty close. Why do we have to shake things up? And I would point them to two important foundations that are big problems. One is that physics relies on 96% of the universe being dark matter and dark energy in order for all this stuff to work, meaning we don't even know what 96% of the universe is, but we need it to be there in order for all of physics to work. I actually start my book in Into the Upside Down Cosmos with the following story about dark matter, which I didn't know about until I started researching this book, because I had heard that 96% figure, but I didn't know where dark matter and dark energy came from. So dark matter was quote unquote discovered in 1933. There was an astronomer looking out in the sky at a cluster of galaxies, and basically things were moving much faster than would have been expected based on Einstein's gravity, his relativity theory. There was missing mass under the theory of relativity. There needed to be more mass there in order for his observations to line up. And it was off by like 99%. There was a ton of missing mass. There were two options at that point. One, to say, we need to rethink Einstein and Newton and why an apple falls to the ground. Maybe there's another reason things are moving in the sky that's not this mystical gravitational force or relativity. And we need to rethink all physics. Or we're going to invent dark matter and say it must be there because obviously Einstein's right. So they plugged in dark matter, and now scientists for many decades have been looking into it to say, well, what is this dark matter stuff? Let's try to understand it. There is a mainstream astrophysicist. Anyone can look him up on Wikipedia. Pavel Krupa at the University of Bonn in Germany, he's out there saying, we are examining the hypotheses proposed by the idea of dark matter, and they're not there. We have falsified dark matter with more than 5 sigma confidence, which is more than 99.999% confidence. He says, it's not there. We have to rethink Einstein's gravity. So there you go. I mean, we could just stop right there. That if that's a foundation of cosmology, we got a big problem. So that's point one. Dark matter and dark energy has problems. That's a separate story. 96% of the universe might not be what we think. Point two, there exists no unified theory of physics. The two leading theories, Einstein's relativity, which, as we just talked about, probably has issues, and then the quantum realm, quantum physics, they do not work together. Apparently, they worked on their own in their relative domains, relativity at the big scales, the cosmic scales, quantum at the smaller scales. But when you bring them together, metaphorically speaking, the equations blow up. And I want to read you and your audience a quote from Michio Kaku, mainstream physicist. He says, there is a crisis in cosmology, usually in science, if we're off by a factor of 2 or a factor of 10, we call that horrible. We say something is wrong with the theory. However, in cosmology, we're off by a factor of 10 to the 120th power. That is 1 with 120 zeros after it. This is the largest mismatch between theory and experiment in the history of science. So, to close out, if you're going to tell me we've got everything pretty well figured out, it's like saying, grant me these miracles, and then we're going to explain everything else to you. So I would direct everyone who's asking questions, why are you questioning the nature of the cosmos? Go back to dark matter and dark energy. Go back to no unified theory of physics, and that we have this massive mismatch. Start there and work our way up. Whereas right now, it seems to me that there's a house of cards. And that's why many people like Dave Weiss and Austin Whitsitt and others are finding these anomalies, because the foundations of physics are broken.
I would be okay with the establishment coming out and saying, we just don't know. We don't have it all figured out. It's such a complicated puzzle. We're just humans. We're doing the best we can. We have ideas and theories about it, but we don't really know for sure. But they never say that, do they? They always have to tell you, we know. This is it. It's established science. It's a or as you know, Fauci said, the science. You know, you can't you can't challenge the science. And just once, I would like them to come out and say, this is our best guess at it. Do you have any idea as to why they have they feel the need to always be so certain, even if they can't prove it? But this certainty, is it just to keep us in a story? I just have never been able to figure this out. I just feel like they'd have so much more credibility if every now and then they said, you know, we know this, this, and this, but this other component, the cosmos, man, we're still working on it. It is a real mystery to me. But they never do that, do they?
No. There is this dogmatism. It almost becomes its form of religion, that we are the field of science and we know the answers and we're going to tell you it's true. And you can only ask questions within this box and anything outside of that is not allowed. And that's really anti-scientific. It's completely hypocritical. From a more nefarious perspective, if one wanted to control the population and control people's perceptions, there would be an incentive to do this, to basically teach the intelligentsia a certain way of thinking and propagate these false narratives and then not encourage them to ask questions. So I don't know how all this works in terms of the chain of command. To me, I think it's a spiritual war at the core, meaning demonic forces that are somehow influencing our world. And this is probably something very ancient, but it works through human beings. And there must be some human beings that understand the deception and are propagating it. And then there are people who grow up in the academic field. I mean, I went to Princeton, for example. I know how that mindset is of basically the reverence for people who have PhDs or who went to a prestigious university. Oh, Mark, you're telling me that all these doctors are wrong about viruses. You're telling me all these PhDs. That can't be right. So you have people who are innocently propagating the narrative because they just respect the establishment so much.
An end to upside down academia coming? Eighth book, maybe? I mean, you went through Princeton and saw this. When our institutions are completely corrupted and manipulated from the inside. I mean, boy, you think you're going to go. I mean, I had this belief that I was going to go off to college and then I was going to get an additional education as on top of whatever I ever got. We're going to build upon the foundation that was set. Maybe I did, but that was also 30 years ago. What's your take on our current trajectory, given how obviously flawed academia is?
I'm pretty concerned, and I might be a bit biased because I have more exposure to that academic world because of my background and my networks, but I would have expected more people who I know to be highly intelligent in certain ways to have woken up to the many deceptions that we've seen, especially since 2020. Whereas I'm finding that many of them are still going along with the narratives and, for example, would treat the New York Times like the Bible, so to speak, as if it were just the beacon of truth. Not to just pick on the New York Times, but you know what I mean? That's, if it's in one of these major periodicals, then it must be true. If it's on this major news station, it must be true. So there is, I don't know how it works. I mean, I think back to MKUltra and mind control techniques. There might be something in there in terms of the way we've all been hypnotized, and especially those in the academic world, hypnotized to believe certain things where it becomes very difficult to depart from that worldview. It's almost like the cognitive dissonance. The discomfort emotionally is too strong for people who have been indoctrinated to depart from their worldview.
When you were, like you mentioned earlier, your work has a thread running through it, like a theme, and it's the role of consciousness in all of this. We all lived through COVID, and we saw, and your An End to Upside Down Medicine, which came out in 2023, looked back on all of this. I wonder, I think about the old philosophers that were writing about how the vaccines were disconnecting people from their souls, writing about this in the early, in the early 30s. And then you live through COVID, you go out into the wild, you have interactions with people, maybe people you know or even people that you don't know, and they feel a bit off to me. Some of them, the ones that took all of the shots, they feel different. The interactions feel different. Even physically, that there's like the light in their eyes has gone out a bit. And I'm wondering, when you were writing this book, What was your experience with that? Did you have people close to you, anyone in your circle that you watched? I mean, it worked as a kind of an interesting control study too, because you know who didn't take the shots because they were quiet about it and they didn't say anything, and you know who did take the shots because they put stickers on and took pictures with donuts in their mouth. So you could tell who was in and who was out. Did you have any experiences with your own little personal control group where you saw things change in these people?
Yeah, for sure. And it was a tough period, I think, for all of us, especially members of your audience, those who are really questioning the narrative, because there was a divide where it was no longer acceptable to question the mainstream narratives. It was considered dangerous at the time. And that's what led me on this path. Basically, my first two books were written before all the lockdowns hit. And then I awoke to the political deception and into upside down liberty and getting into anarchism and anarcho-capitalism, things like that. And then these other areas too, including medicine. What I'm not sure of is cause and effect in some of these cases. There's clearly dangerous stuff in these injections. We know from the Pfizer papers, these were papers that were forced to be disclosed by courts, thousands and thousands of papers. Dr. Naomi Wolf has been involved in basically analyzing Pfizer's reports, showing that the vaccines were not what we were told, that there were problems with safety and efficacy and some scary stuff in those papers. So we know there are issues with the injections, certainly, and we know there are no long-term studies. So that could be part of what you're describing. But I also wonder if what you're picking up on is a disconnection with the nature of reality. It's going along almost robotically with the narratives as if they are the truth. Whereas I think questioning the narratives is getting us much closer to the truth, and probably in a manner that's much more spiritually connected. That's what I'm finding, Charlie, is that among the community of people who are asking questions, there's almost a light I see in their eyes of genuine curiosity and genuine skepticism where there should be skepticism. And that seems to correlate with a spiritual connection. And that might be lacking in some of the people that are just going along with the narrative. Not to pick political sides, but especially like in academia, there is this left-wing bias. And that left-wing bias tends to be more materialistic, more atheistic. And those are the people that would say, Mark, your first book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, questioning whether the brain produces consciousness. You're talking about the science of the soul. That's crazy talk. That kind of mentality exists in a big way. And I think people who have that mentality, and that I was in that crew, by the way, for many, many years until up in 2016. There might be a tampering down of the soul in some way because it's a disconnection from reality.
What's been the response from your friends and family who know you, who've watched this transformation over the last decade? What have they, you go to a Thanksgiving dinner? Is there a closeted uncle who comes up to you and goes, nice work, buddy. You've been doing good. You know, like, is there somebody in your life who is extremely supportive of this? Are there people in your life that think like, whoa, like we were on board with the beginning stuff, but now you've gone into some territory and we're having a hard time keeping up with you. How's the response been?
The response in general has been very quiet. Family, public, and otherwise. Like, not many people approaching me or even contact me. And I find in my networks, and even some close friends and family members, don't even really know what I'm talking about. They know I've written a bunch of books, and maybe they know my first book was on consciousness and it gets into spiritual topics, which they may or may not agree with. The other thing is like, oh, you wrote a book on medicine and politics, but they don't know really what I'm talking about. And I wonder what they would think if they knew. So it's almost like a repellent. It's like they're not drawn to it, perhaps, because it's just not in their psyche. I mean, a lot of the people in these networks are focused on exclusively the next promotion or, you know, more material things, versus what I'm talking about is much more philosophical, so they're not drawn to it. And for that reason, I haven't had too much conflict, which has been kind of nice. I'm also not out there, unless people want to talk to me about it, I'm not pushing it on them. If I know someone's not going to be open, I don't bring it up.
Yeah. What about your book on contact? Did that get people? I mean, I'm sure people, That's a pretty polarizing one. What did you learn writing that book about contact? Because it feels like I would just call it the UFO industrial complex, right? There's something going on here. There's a, you know, To the Stars Academy, who's got 75 years of CIA experience sitting on their board of directors, which I would think would be an automatic disqualification to anybody, or, you know, the Lou Elizondos of the world saying, yeah, I was CIA, but I'm good CIA. I'm a white hat, you know, all this stuff. And then it gets sort of mainstreamed and put on Rogan and everybody's kind of talking about it. What was your take on all of this? It's sort of become fashionable to be talking about UFOs and contact and things like that.
And that has shifted. My book, An End to Upside Down Contact, came out in 2022. So maybe it was just starting to shift. There was a New York Times article a few years before that really brought things to the forefront. But what I find is that it's a treacherous territory, because there is a lot of disinformation potential and people coming out with different stories that we can't really validate. And what I tried to do in that book, because I couldn't pinpoint what was going on, the way I describe it is like taking a Venn diagram of different circles and seeing where those independent circles overlap. When you get a lot of the same things from many different independent sources throughout human history, maybe there's something there. If you hear just something from one person as the only source, it's much harder to know what's going on. But perhaps the biggest concern I have with the ongoing UFO narrative is that it seems to be focused on the physical elements of the phenomenon, meaning a physical craft and maybe the technologies associated with it, which is certainly important. I don't want to downplay that. But where I focused a lot of that book, An End to Upside Down Contact, is on the metaphysical elements of contact, whether it's in a near-death experience state or a psychedelic state or people channeling or people doing remote viewing, sending their mind out in space and time, which has been validated by the U.S. government in declassified documents. In all these instances and more, people are reporting other beings that they encountered, that they interacted with. Some of those beings are benevolent. Others are highly malevolent. So there seems to be a spectrum of good and evil. And that's what I got into in that book. There seems to be a spiritual war. And unless we acknowledge the consciousness element, that there might be multidimensional aspects, and it's not just a craft mm-hmm. coming from some sure. faraway place, which now with my current view on cosmology, I don't know if the things are as far away as we're told. There might be other lands. Some people have speculated there are lands beyond what we know. But I don't know. There's this interdimensional aspect, however, which exists independently of any cosmological beliefs, which that might be where the heart of the matter is. And we're seeing in this UFO industrial complex much more focus on the material stuff exclusively.
I had an interesting conversation with two family members, former family members. They were my ex-wife's family. And the wife was, they were both in their 60s, I'd say, early 60s, late 50s. The wife is a little kooky, you know, but super smart, but a little, you know, a little woo-woo, a little out there. And she's talking about how her family, meaning her and her four other sisters, had encounters with crafts and beings their entire life, that they just knew wherever they were, it would always happen to them, almost like they had been kind of tagged in some way, or they'd been deemed as like, let's follow these people throughout the course of their life. And she told me about these encounters that she had, and I had no reason to think that she was lying, but I also, since I wasn't there, it's also hard for me to say with 100% certainty that I think that, you know, that I understand what she's talking about. But what did it for me was her husband. It had the two of them together. And then her husband, who is not a woo-woo guy. Think of an investment banker, you know, think of a guy who's really successful and really wealthy and powerful and has a lot of money and doesn't tolerate a bunch of bullshit and isn't, you know, dismissive of all these other things. And have that guy say, we were sitting in our bed and just about to go to sleep. And at the foot of a bed, this thing just appeared, like a small gray. And before I could figure out what was going on, it touched my foot and I was paralyzed and I felt like I was having a heart attack. And then it let go of me and it just vanished. Now, if she had told me that story, I'd have been like, okay, well, you know, I guess I believe you to an extent. The fact he added credibility in my mind, because he was the last person in the world I would think would ever say something like that. And for him to say, oh, I saw it too. I thought she was crazy until it happened to me. I went, oh my God. You know, so then I've had that in my mind from that point on. When you were writing a book about contact,
what are we talking about here? Are we, I mean, cause I'm with you. I'm starting to think this stuff is interdimensional, and the way he described this being sort of being in the room and then disintegrating and not being in the room anymore. He didn't walk out the door. He didn't jump out the window or anything like that. He was there and he wasn't there. So it makes me think that they're blurring the lines of dimension, interdimensional shifts, and maybe it just kind of takes one step over into our dimension and then takes a step out and it's out of our dimension and you can't see it anymore. So what did you find with any of this? Did you talk to people who had experiences like this, or what was the interdimensional component of this?
One thing I'd say is that these reports that we're hearing in the modern era, there are analogs of these modern reports in many religious and spiritual traditions. And even the actual lore and the documents, which some people might call myth. But now that I look at them with what we're hearing from people in the modern era, they might have just been using different language back then to describe similar phenomena of these beings they encountered. And maybe they called them angels, whereas now someone calls them an alien or a spirit. We might be referring to similar things. Also, I found it very interesting that John Mack, who was the head of psychiatry at Harvard and a Pulitzer Prize winner, late in his career, he encountered these accounts of people alleging that they were abducted by alien beings. And he said, I'm going to explore this. And he concluded that something was up. He wrote a book called Abduction and then Passport to the Cosmos in the 90s. And these are very detailed books written by the former head of psychiatry at Harvard. So you can imagine they're very meticulous. He concluded something is going on here on a multidimensional level. And he was tying it back to consciousness as well. But he spoke about some phenomena based on the people that he was working with as a psychiatrist to try to evaluate the claims, because they were coming to him saying, yeah, I was on an operating room table and these alien beings were basically doing some kind of breeding to create hybrids. I mean, this is Harvard guy talking about hybrid human aliens, crazy stuff. But he said in one of his books, the alien beings appear to be consummate shapeshifters, meaning they have an ability to shift their form or the way they appear to us, meaning they have an ability potentially to manipulate reality in human in the ways that humans might have a capacity to do, but we haven't learned about it or it's been suppressed. Along similar lines, there's a phenomenon known as screen memories, where, for example, a man named Mike Clellan has written books about this, where a person will see an owl on the side of the road and he'll go up to the owl. And then all of a sudden, hours have passed. There's this phenomenon, missing time, commonly reported. And then he's driving home. He's like, I don't know what happened. I saw that owl. There was missing time. I don't know what happened in those intervening hours. So the person goes to visit a hypnotherapist to see if there's a way to recover those memories. And the hypnotherapist brings the person to a relaxed state and says, okay, I want you to bring yourself back to that place where you were driving your car on the side of the road. Go up to the owl. Please explain to me what the owl looks like. And the person will say, wait a second. That's not an owl. It's a gray alien. So the implication is that these beings might have an ability to alter our memory of what they actually are. And it's not just owls. It's raccoons, deer, like different animals have been reported. Even Kerry Mullis, who invented the PCR test, Nobel Prize winner, he wrote in his autobiography, he encountered a glowing raccoon who said, good evening, doctor, something like that. And then he had a bunch of missing time in the woods.
What? Whoa. That is crazy. I did not know that. And I'm fully willing to also add that military abductions could play a role in this. I'm open to the possibility that there's, especially when you start to hear people recounting stories as I woke up on an operating table, there were a bunch of grays there. And then there was a guy like a human wearing a military outfit and standing in the corner, not doing anything, clearly like the boss, but sort of directing them. What about this? What about the potential MILAB component to this? Yeah. These stories?
Super important. I include that in the book as well. It's very difficult to discern what's what based on these accounts, because there are sometimes military personnel with the alleged aliens that people report. But there are some phenomena, for example, in Dr. Rick Strassman's work on DMT, he wrote the book DMT, The Spirit Molecule. What he talked about in that book is that when he was giving people DMT intravenously, many of them were encountering beings. And they describe things, incidentally, that resemble very much what John Mack was hearing from people who claimed to have been abducted. So these were people who took DMT and they were having abduction-like experiences. Many of them didn't know anything about the abduction phenomenon. Neither did Rick Strassman. But he basically said, As strange as this sounds, I need to understand what this abduction phenomenon is. And John Mack of Harvard, who studied abductions, endorsed Rick Strassman's book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. Oh, wow. So that to me indicates maybe there's an interdimensional element to some of these accounts that don't have military components. And there might also be my labs too. I'm not sure.
I've done DMT several times. I have never seen an entity. And I've kind of had my eyes open, so to speak. I mean, I know that you can machine elves and things like that, or tricksters or whatever. And I never saw anything like that. I'm always kind of keeping my eyes open, but I have watched DMT, the Spirit Molecule on more than one occasion. And it's a fascinating look into what's going on. Yeah. What is the role of the pineal gland in all of this? Because you've done extensive work on consciousness. We have this very unusual part of our brain that is mysterious and creates this substance that, our stomach destroys as it goes down and makes it so that we're not tripping all day long on DMT. We're able to piece things together. And then you see symbology from the Catholic Church and ancient sculptures of everybody with this pine cone symbol in their staff or in their artwork. What's the role of the pineal gland in these experiences?
Yeah, I've talked to some scientists about this. I don't think it's fully understood yet, but it could be that there is a part of our body that is related to connection with these other worlds. And that when the substances are taken in a certain way, like with ayahuasca, apparently the DMT is not metabolized as much, so it can stay in the body for much longer. Right. But the fact that our body has this seeming tie to substances that can connect people to other worlds, it does raise questions about what is the human body really? How should we be connecting with these other worlds? And along those lines, I want to read you a quote from Rick Strassman. Because one of his volunteers in the DMT study, he said, "I feel like I was in an alien laboratory in a hospital bed. I was being carted around. There was one main creature, and he seemed to be behind it all, overseeing everything. There were other orderlies. They activated a sexual circuit, and I was flushed with an amazing orgasmic energy. They were checking instruments, testing things. I knew they were preparing something for me, something we had a mission." So that's, he goes on and on. But these very alien-like encounters in the DMT space that John Mack was seeing separately. So what is it about DMT that is something that we scientists believe is produced by the body that could connect us to these other worlds? Actually, funny enough, Charlie, at Confluence this year, there was a tent set up that had artifacts that I had never seen before. They were excavated in Mexico, and they had imagery from Egypt, very clearly Egyptian imagery, like Anubis and Thoth and things that you would expect to see in Egypt. But one of the key differences was that there were beings with elongated skulls, which we sort of see in Egyptian imagery, but also the elongated skull went back. So it looked like alien from a science fiction movie. And they had these slit eyes. It was very creepy to see these clearly alien looking beings amidst other things that looked Egyptian. There was one image that I saw where it was one of these alien-looking beings across from a human-looking being, and the human was apparently taking notes. It looked like it had a pencil or something. Oh. So very bizarre phenomena, which, you know, and I go into this in the book and into Upside Down Contact. These are ancient phenomena about that could potentially relate to human origins, that these intelligences might have been influencing humanity throughout all time, including now.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of going to Egypt when I was in high school and spending time there and going through the Cairo Museum and seeing everything and people telling you, oh, this is only part of it. You know, there's so much other stuff that's off limits. It's way down in the basements. And I just thought, boy, I mean, we don't really know our history. I mean, we get told what our history is, and you look at the pyramids and they tell you they've been here for 5,000 years. And then I come across Graham Hancock's work, and you say, well, you know, I mean, if we're being honest here, Joel Anthony West is talking about the erosion patterns on the Sphinx, and it's showing that it has been here for much longer, back at a time when this area of the world was more lush and filled with greenery and rain. And obviously, if you've been to
if you've been to the Giza Plateau, there's nothing there but dirt, right? It's just, there's nothing growing out there. So he's saying that the math doesn't add up, the timing doesn't add up, and you get Zahi Hawass is recently on Rogan. He comes out, shits the bed in that interview. He looks like the gatekeeper of information that everyone has always called him out to be. What do I know you haven't written a book on this yet, but what do we make of Egypt? I mean, that's such a, it's such an amazing, I mean, you want to talk about feeling insignificant. I was standing right next, looking up at the pyramids, thinking to myself, these have been here for, I don't know how many generations. And here I am in my, I'm 16 years old. I'll live a life. I'll die. They'll still be here. And we'll still not know the whole story about this. What have you ever thought about or gotten into what our role is in the whole story of Egypt?
I mean, it's come up in my research all over the place, and pyramids in general, they're found all over the world. And why was it that I was looking at artifacts from Mexico that had Egyptian imagery, but then also Mexican imagery, like some of the skulls that you would see in other Mexican things? So why that kind of destroys the historical time frame to have Egyptian imagery in Mexico that you're excavating. So it speaks to a question about human history. What was really going on? Who knows how long ago? What kind of technology did they have? And why is that being obfuscated now? Like, why is there such a specific narrative about what Egypt is? And don't worry, this is how they made the pyramids. And it's this very cookie cutter narrative, which takes away the potentially mystical elements.
Have you sort of felt the way I feel, which is that there's got to be some sort of suppressed technology that they don't want us talking about, whether it's sound technology, you know, the levitating stones or moving them around, the idea of human slaves dragging these stones. I mean, I saw where the Nile was in relation to the Giza Plateau. You're not dragging these stones over there. There had to have been some other system. Is this an example of these stories being told, be they Egyptian folklore or the shape of the earth or something, to hide the fact that there is some sort of technology that is suppressed, that the elites, I put air quotes on that one because I don't consider them to be actually elite, but you know, they do, that they've got this technology. It's sort of down in the, I don't know, for lack of a better term, down in the Vatican basement somewhere, that they've known about all along. And if we were to get a true picture of our history, well, then we would have major questions about what sort of technology was used. Do you have any thoughts on the suppression of technology over the years?
Yeah, and it actually relates to the question on cosmology, because what happened in the late 1800s was that the ether was taken out of physics. Ether is known as the fifth element in ancient traditions. The others, earth, air, fire, and water, the four elements. The fifth is ether, which might be likened to a background substrate. I like to think about it as like a spiritual interface through which what we call the material world or light or anything is the modulation or the vibration of ether, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's this very important background medium, but the physicists, because of the way they interpreted studies in the late 1800s, one is called Aries' failure, another one is called the Michelson-Morley study of 1887. They had a very specific presupposition built into their interpretation of the studies. They presupposed that Earth was moving, and therefore they interpreted the studies through some complicated things to get rid of ether. But if you assume that Earth was actually stationary, you could look at it the other way. Actually, the results would have made sense with an ether and a stationary Earth. So Robert Bennett is a good resource on this. He's a physics PhD. He wrote his thesis on relativity and comes from a lineage where one of the advisors worked directly with Einstein. And now he's out there saying, you know, Einstein came after these 1800 studies and was part of basically removing ether from physics because they presuppose that Earth is moving and they got rid of ether. This is to your question about technology, because if ether is real, and we haven't been considering that in physics, is there a background medium that we could be drawing from energetically? Would we then think about vibration and frequency differently in physics and all of technology? Might there be free energy? And this gets into Tesla-esque worlds of, you know, the potential to liberate people and to heal people in new ways if we bring back this ancient concept that has been taken out of physics.
Yeah. When you were at Confluence, did they have a Tesla machine there?
I didn't see one.
Because at Anarchapulco, Berwick has one. So he had it set up in his RV, and it
to be honest, it looks like it shouldn't work. You know, it looks like a kind of cartoonish. You're holding onto these like light bulbs and putting another light bulb like on your body, and you can smell ozone. You know, they turn the machine on and you feel there's something going on. We had a camera guy with us, and he couldn't get his camera near it because it was making his viewfinder all wobbly, so he had to get far enough away from it. But I watch people use that, and just the idea that there's healing technology out there that's a little bit different. Obviously, anybody who's ever done DMT or Bufo will know that part of the trip when you close your eyes is this harmonics, this vibrational buzzing that's in your head, and it feels like it revs up into this real high revolution buzzing that feels like it's, you know, it feels like you're getting almost like a sound bath from it. And so I wondered about the frequencies. We know that they've changed the musical, you know, from 432 to 440 and messed with that. I think one of the better examples that I've seen of the power of this vibrational technology is when someone puts like a clear plexiglass piece over a camera, puts the camera underneath it and dumps sand on it. And then they turn on the music and start to rev it, at a certain speed. And then they change it and they get it down to 432. The vibration starts to make these sacred geometrical patterns with the sand. And you go, oh my God, it's just doing this automatically. Is that the real secret? You think maybe that they're suppressing the fact that there is ether, that there's a component that we're not even looking at. There's an element we're not even looking at. You can't be looking at the fifth element if we only think there's four. Mm-hmm. And so that's been hidden away, and the power of vibration and the power of sound frequencies. And I felt during one of my DMT ceremonies that I was getting scanned like all the way around my body, but it was scanning me with sound vibrations. I don't know what it was checking for. It felt like I was going through like a interdimensional car wash or something like that. And as soon as it was done with the scan, boom, I just took off into like a whole nother dimension. Have you looked into the sound frequencies or anything like that? Or come across, I'll send you a link to the Tesla stuff, by the way. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I've only heard about that. I'm familiar with Eileen McCusick's work. She's a friend of mine, for example. She's arguably like the world's leading biofield tuner. And she's done that work on me where she has a tuning fork and she's basically using frequency to adjust our energetic field. That's paraphrasing her work. So, and that's the realm that we might be headed towards in order to heal ourselves. And I do get into this in my book on An End to Upside Down Medicine, acknowledging the role of the biofield in human health, because that's completely ignored by allopathic medicine.
Yeah, I shared a cab with her at an Acapulco. That's how I met her. We were coming from the airport at the same time. She's super nice. And I said, what do you do? She goes, she explained her, and then I would see her at the conference, and that's one of the components of an Acapulco that I like. Everyone goes, well, it's fuck the government conference. I go, yeah, well, that's day one, but day three is more like sacred geometry and healing crystals and all the kind of the woo woo stuff. There's all those people there, and I've just sat in the audience and listened to it because I don't have that background, don't know a ton about it, but Eileen was fantastic. And everyone that and then afterwards I said, I met Eileen. They go, oh, she's the best. Everyone I talked to said, oh yeah, she's the best. So I think there's something to it. And of course it also feels like there's even more to it when the people that are talking about it get suppressed. You know what I mean? It's like the worst thing they could do. It's like the Streisand effect for this stuff. If they weren't trying to suppress people from talking about it, I might be dismissive of it, but the fact that they don't want you guys talking about any of this makes me think, well, maybe there is some there, or we are living in a vibrational universe, are we not?
Exactly. But it's the mainstream allopathic approach is materialistic. It likes to reduce everything to physical particles, like little billiard balls hitting each other. And that's the mechanism of reality. If we're talking about vibration or interdimensional aspects or even ether, we're getting into a spiritual realm that's beyond scientific materialism. So mainstream medicine is just going to throw this stuff out because they have a materialist bias.
Yeah. What a shame. What do you, where do you go from here?
Good question.
I mean, what do you, how do you pick your topics? Just whatever's interesting to you at the time. I mean, because you've got the Great Reset. You've got, you've got Cosmos, Medicine, Contact. You're all over the place with this. Where do you go from here? What's next?
Well, first of all, it feels like the topics choose me. I get hooked on something. I mean, I didn't know I was going to write about any of these things. I wrote my first book and I thought I was done. My publisher said, what's going to be next? And I was like, what do you mean? I'm going to go back to my job, because I was still working in Silicon Valley. And he actually came up with the title An End to Upside Down Thinking. He had the foresight, because he had way more experience, that the world's upside down. He knew that. And I was able to keep that title and then look at Upside Down Liberty and so forth. So I always tell people it's possible I'll never write another book. I would have to get that lightning bolt of inspiration and passion to go down the road that we're both familiar with, of wanting to write a book and go through the editorial process. It's not pleasant. I do the audiobooks myself also, which is a crazy editorial process where I narrate. It's worth it for a passionate project, but I'd have to find something I'm that passionate about. And what I'm finding now is that there is more receptivity to all of the things that I'm talking about, the things you're talking about, and I enjoy speaking to people. I mean, it's fun doing these remote podcasts, but being in person at Confluence, for example, or other festivals where you can look in people's eyes. I mean, this conference, actually, I didn't have any slides. I didn't know exactly what I was going to say. I wanted to wait until I could see everyone there to figure out, like, energetically what was going to work and resonate with the audience. And I like being in that mode of really trying to communicate these things that I've spent so much time on to just share. So maybe there'll be more of that.
I met my first in Acapulco on the way there. I was in the Mexico City airport waiting to get on my flight to Acapulco. And there was G. Edward Griffin was there. And poor guy, you know, he was trapped. He couldn't get away from me. And so I sat next to him and said, hey, I'm going to see you. I'm going to see you tomorrow. We're both speaking there. You know, I'm excited to hear your speech. What are you going to be presenting on? And he goes, you know, I don't know. And I thought, what? You don't know? I mean, here I had I'd done the PowerPoint, you know, I had my PowerPoint slides and I was ready. I knew what I was going to do. And he said, I don't know. He goes, I want to get there and see how everybody is and see what the vibe is. And then I'll know what to talk about. And that was the last time I wrote a speech was after talking to him. I said, you know, the next couple of times I've been, what is your talk going to be on? Well, I'll know when I get there. And because I thought that was such a experienced way to, you know, from somebody who he's forgotten more about all of these topics than I'll ever know. And to sit there and I thought he was going to say, well, you know, I'm going to get into this and this and this and the Federal Reserve and the he just said he wanted to let the conference dictate where he was going. So it's funny to hear you say that, because apparently you are tapping into the great G. Edward Griffin's mindset on this as well, which is, I'll know what to talk about when I see the people in the audience, and that's how I'll. Where are you going to be speaking next? What's your plan for 2025? What do you have cooking?
The Living Free Festival. It is north of Brisbane, Australia.
Wow.
I didn't attend last year, but apparently it was a great festival. And I've heard that it's similar to Confluence in that it's challenging all sorts of ideas, but I've never been before. And it sounds like it's going to be fun.
And what's the best place for people to support your work, find your books, and follow you on social media?
My website is just my name, markgober.com, markgober.com. I'm on social media, Instagram, Facebook, X, Mark Gober Author. And all 7 books are on Amazon in hard copy, Kindle, and Audible formats, where I narrate the Audible. I also have a podcast series, which people still listen to, from 2019. It's only 8 episodes, so people can binge it pretty quickly. It's on the nature of consciousness, the scientific evidence of psychic phenomena. I interviewed Dr. Diane Powell, for example, back then, who is now famous for the telepathy tapes, but she talked about similar phenomena with me back then, the afterlife, near-death experience, all that stuff. So Where Is My Mind on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the major players.
That's Mark Gober, everybody. Go check out his amazing work. Buy his books. Buy his books for somebody that you think might be open to it. You know, a little present. And if you want to connect with me, macroaggressions.io is the best place to do that. Please go bookmark Activist Post and Natural Blaze. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.